From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, what might we hear from Governor Snyder in his third State of the State speech?
Snyder views these speeches more so as report cards than he does rah-rah sessions.
Plus, we'll explore the challenges in diagnosing and treating mental illness in Michigan.
So is that what it's come to? That if you have a mental illness in Michigan, you're looking for treatment in jail?
On the 30th anniversary of its closing, we look back at the downtown Detroit Hudsons.
It was a destination. You made a day of it. You got dressed up to go there.
Plus, we get a view of Michigan and its people through the eyes of a photographer from Minnesota.
There's as much interesting things for me to look at in Flint as there is in, Bangladesh.
Those stories and much more on today's Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we'll look at access to mental health services in Michigan. How is our state doing in terms of screening and treatment? Also, this week marks the 30th anniversary of the closing of the big store, Hudson's Department Store in downtown Detroit. Just why was the world's largest department store so special for so many in Southeast Michigan? We'll find out. But first, Governor Snyder delivers his third State of the State address at the Capitol this evening. Joining us for a look ahead at what we're likely to hear is Chris Gouts. He's the Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Welcome, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
So there has been a lot of talk, Chris. In fact, the governor himself has said that he plans to outline a framework for transportation funding in his address this evening. What do you think we're likely to hear?
Well, that's the subject of much discussion and consternation in some areas. I think most people expect that we're going to see him call for an increase in registration fees. It's something that he sort of put on the table in 2011 in his special message on transportation and infrastructure, and it didn't go anywhere like much of what he suggested. He sort of sold it as a $10 a month increase to try to make it more palatable. But, of course, I mean, we all know that you don't pay your registration fees monthly. It's like a reverse birthday present you get in the mail from the state.
That's right.
Money from you. So that didn't really go anywhere. But that is seems to be the way in which he's going to try to generate as much revenue as he can, because it's seen as a more stable system, because the system we have right now relies on registration fees and the gas tax. And so with more fuel-efficient vehicles, like we saw, you know, this week at the auto show,
yeah.
You know, that's becoming more the rate. So it's harder to rely on that revenue because people are getting more bang for their buck at the pump, and they're not stopping as often. So he's trying to head that off, because that's becoming a problem across the country.
And might we see a call, though, for higher taxes for gas, which would not make anyone happy? And I suppose especially people who rely on tourism in Michigan wouldn't like that.
No, I don't think we are going to see that. And I know that that there are some who think that's just the solution. If you're not getting as much revenue from it, then you should just raise the tax and get the revenue you need. Mm-hmm. That's not the way that he has presented in the past going to try to fix this, and I don't think that's what he's going to do now. He's actually called for, in the past, to actually eliminate the gas tax altogether and tax it at the wholesale level. So in all likelihood, people at the pump would actually sort of see a wash. You probably wouldn't see any difference, but it's another way in which to try to stabilize that revenue stream. That's what other states have recommended doing. One thing in particular, I wrote about this week, in Virginia, they're doing something which was derided as being referred to as hippie punching. This is a proposal in Virginia where they're proposing a $100 fee for anyone who drives an alternative fuel vehicle. So for every Prius or Chevy Volt out there, you have to pay an extra $100 because you're viewed as sort of part of the problem because you're not showing up at the pump and you're not paying the gas tax.
Okay.
So I don't expect any hippie punching from the governor, but that is something that has been suggested in other states. So I know that there will be some who will be watching for that.
I have to thank you, Chris, because that term is going to be in my mind all day now. That's just hilarious. We're talking with Chris Gouts, who's the Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business, kind of looking ahead at what we might hear tonight from Governor Snyder in his third State of the State address, and certainly with the sense that he's going to outline a framework for transportation funding. The question is, Chris, why transportation funding and why now?
Well, it's one of the big pieces of his agenda that he never wasn't able to convince his fellow Republicans to do beforehand, just because it was there were so many other things that were going on. There were so many tough votes, and it was an election, you know, year around the time that he was proposing this. Lawmakers were in the House were considering, you know, I need to get reelected. I can't vote for a massive tax increase or some shift that's going to be seen as a tax increase. But the governor wants, you know, between $1 billion and $1.4 billion in new revenue, and that's just to maintain the crumbling infrastructure that we have. As a side note, that number that you'll hear probably tonight and that we've heard for the last year or so came from a report that was done by two House members who are no longer with us in the legislature, Rick Olson and Roy Schmidt. Rick Olson was a Republican who his colleagues tossed aside during redistricting so badly that he contemplated running as a Democrat.
Okay.
And Troy Schmidt, who later then became a Republican.
Yes.
And then lost after the resulting scandal. So it'll be interesting to see who in the House will pick up the ball and sort of be the mouthpiece for, you know, the administration's charge of, yes, we do need $1 billion more in revenue.
Do you think it's likely the governor will get anything that he wants in terms of transportation funding this time around?
I think yes, because I think there is a realization that we do need to get something done. When this came out in October of 2011, it didn't really go anywhere. And there was even some question as to whether, especially in the House, there were folks that were in key positions that were saying, we don't have a $1 billion problem. We can do this maybe $200 million or $400 million. That's as far as we're willing to go. And in Speaker Bolger's first speech of the new session, he said, you know, we need to fix this $1 billion problem. So just the acknowledgement that the speaker has that there is a $1 billion problem that needs to be fixed, I think that opens the door to getting something done. The rush, though, is that people want to go ahead and start raising taxes, and that's not where the speaker's at all. Neither are any Republicans that I'm aware of. So
right.
It has to be done in a way that can be seen as sort of not raising taxes if you can find revenue in other places and put it together. And they really have to get it done this year, because then everyone is up for re-election, including the governor.
There you go. What other issues, Chris, do you think we'll hear Governor Snyder address?
Well, I think there's a few things. One of the things that he's really big on is this idea of connecting jobs and talent. He talks about this website, you know, that there are all these great jobs, that there's some 40,000 jobs out there, but people don't have the skills to get them. So he's bringing together the education community and the business community this spring in separate forums to talk about how do we get, you know, people prepared for those jobs. And so I think that's going to be a selling point that he's going to continue to make. And I'm sure they'll also talk about education, and especially the Education Achievement Authority, which is one of the big leftovers from the lame duck session that the governor had wanted. And the Democrats, of course, will say there's no real evidence that the system even works. It's not been around that long. So why are you trying to take it statewide? And then, of course, there was this story just recently that the EAA needed an extra $2 million in funding just to keep it going. So I'm sure Democrats will say, you know, you can't make it work when it's a small program. We're not going to make it a large program.
Let's talk about the tone. Do you think it'll be combative and stand your ground, or is it time to be a little more conciliatory, especially after everything that happened in lame duck and right to work and all of that, especially the way the year ended?
Well, it will be interesting to see sort of what sort of acknowledgement he gives to, you know, that feeling that's going to be present, and also outside where protests are expected. I'm sure that they're crafting something to sort of acknowledge that and to sort of move forward. He's not, you know, a combative, you know, type. He's not a, you know, Scott Walker or a Rick Scott,
right?
Republican governor. He's not, although Democrats will say that the policies that he signs are very Walker-esque, his tone that he gives off is not that in any way. So that'll be interesting to watch. But also, he expect to hear about what's been done, because Snyder views these speeches more so as report cards than he does rah-rah sessions. So there's not going to be proclamations that we're all going to be blown away by one of his plans. You know, he loves these dashboards, and so he said early on that, you know, he views these speeches as a chance to talk about goals and that they set the previous year, and then show people on these dashboards where they are in each of these goals, and then set new ones. So it's more like a report card, you know, a parent-teacher conference than it is, you know, anything else. So I think that's why last year's was so panned, because I think he was trying to do some of that, and it didn't come off as well as other speeches have in the past.
Now, of course, we know the Democrats will come out with their response after the speech. What do you think we're going to be hearing from them?
Well, they're going to say, you know, this is just more of the same. You know, they already had
yes.
sort of a preemptive strike yesterday with Minority Leader Grimal, gave his what he called the real state of our state address. And, you know, they look at this and they say, you know, the governor has given, you know, $2 billion in tax breaks to businesses. He's cut education. You know, he's done so many things that have hurt the middle class. He's raised taxes on seniors with the pension tax and the middle class. with some of the deductions that have gone away. So they're going to say, especially with transportation, they're not going to be on board for anything that looks like it's just another hit out of a middle-class taxpayer's pocketbook. So those are the things they're going to be looking for. I'm sure they're going to be looking for, okay, you've asked so much of the everyday person, you know, is the business community going to pick some of this up? You know, I don't expect that, but I think that's what they're going to be looking for, is some parity and not just another dip into the wallets of everyday citizens.
And in our last minute, Chris, if I dare challenge you here to go out on a limb, what do you think the big headline will be coming out of the speech when we open up the papers or turn on the newscast tomorrow morning?
You know, I've got to go with transportation. I think that seems to be the biggest push that he's going to make. Although, you know, so much has been made ahead of time about that I wonder if there's something, you know, lurking out there that's going to surprise everyone that could come out. You know, it's very possible that he might talk about guns. You know, at the end of last year, he vetoed that controversial gun bill and then asked his administration to come up with some ideas about school safety and gun safety. So especially in light of the president's comments today, that might be something that he comes out with. But I think if he talks about transportation and he talks about the need to raise registration fees, you know, that dollar amount is going to be probably the headline in every paper.
Chris Geltz is the Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Chris, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michigan Radio will carry live coverage of the governor's address beginning this evening at 7. Join Michigan Radio's Jen White and Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta for the speech, the Democratic response from State Senator Gretchen Whitmer, and, of course, lots of analysis of the evening. Again, coverage begins right here on Michigan Radio tonight at 7. And be sure to join us here on Stateside tomorrow at 3. We will talk with Governor Rick Snyder about his address and speak with Democratic Minority Leader Representative Tim Grimmel. And up next, we look at access to mental health services in Michigan. Just how is our state doing when it comes to diagnosing and treating mental illness? This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. We turn now to a problem that is challenging families, police, courts, and the prison system in Michigan. How to handle mentally ill people in our state. With the closing of most of our state's psychiatric hospitals through the 90s and early 2000s, and deep cuts in community mental health programs, state prisons and county jails are holding thousands of inmates who are mentally ill. Judge Milton Mack has had a front row view of the poor way that Michigan treats its mentally ill. He is the chief judge of Wayne County Probate Court. And someone else who's right there in the trenches trying to help mentally ill patients is psychiatrist Dr. Michelle Reed, who's the medical director of the Detroit Wayne County Community Mental Health Agency. And I want to welcome both of you and thank you for joining us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Judge Mack, I want to start with you. In the 20 years that you have been a Wayne County probate judge, that pretty much coincides with the closing of most of Michigan's psychiatric hospitals and then the concurrent failure by the state to provide the promised increased funding and resources to the community mental health agencies. So how has this been reflected in your courtroom?
Well, it's been reflected in more misery. I just see case after case of people who didn't get timely treatment. If they'd had timely treatment, I wouldn't see them. We have a mental health model in Michigan, which is based on an inpatient model for mental health treatment. But we live in an outpatient world. The mental health code was written in 1974 and is very good at what it intended to do, which was to prevent mental health treatment, and does a great job at that and still does today. Today, we know that early intervention helps people survive, helps people recover, helps people lead normal lives. But the mental health code is designed to not permit that to happen.
And when you see these individuals in your courtroom, what's the status?
I see very few cases where there's a question of fact as to whether a person needs treatment. I see long histories of mental illness. Statewide, judges order treatment in almost 99% of the cases because we don't even see the close cases anymore. We see people who have families who come in front of us who've been desperately trying to get help for family members and can't get it. And I see nothing but frustration by family members and broken lives.
There's one estimate that at least 20% of the inmates in Michigan are severely mentally ill. Dr. Michelle Reed, does that figure surprise you?
Yes, studies have been done by the state of Michigan, looking actually interviewing people in prison and looking at the rates of mental disorders, and it ranges anywhere from 15 to 30%. I would like to correct one misperception. Although you are entirely accurate that there's many less state psychiatric facilities than there have been in the past, I think we're down to six now, the majority of funding for those facilities, when they closed, went into community mental health. So over the last 20 years, there has been a massive expansion in the budget for community mental health, but that expansion in the budget has not really kept up with the demand for services. And I think there are other factors that also impact that. You hear the judge talking about the need for early intervention, and again, the issue of stigma. There's a stigma to having a mental disorder, and people often don't come for help early because there's a perception in the community that this makes a person less than and it's not acceptable, and that's something that we have to continue to fight on a daily basis.
Dr. Reed, I've seen a quote where you have characterized Judge Mack's approach to the mentally ill as what you call a downstream approach, while you're pushing for what you call an upstream approach. Could you explain that for us?
Right. I think what we're talking about, Judge Mack is talking to you about a person who, he talks about both. He talks about a person who's already identified as mentally ill, a person who's coming to the court. The issue is, as Judge Mack is telling you, that many of these individuals we may have been able to know even as early as kindergarten or first, second, third grade, elementary school, that there were issues with these individuals. In other words, there were school failures, there were family problems and other issues. The early intervention model is to put more money and energy, not waiting until the person needs to be part of the court or the juvenile justice system, but to get to them in elementary school, work it with the Head Start programs, work in preschool programs to identify people at risk for mental disorders and make needed services available. In Chicago, they have a number of programs relative to a public health or approach they took to children who have had adverse exposure to violence. So children who are exposed to violence at a young age have a tendency to experience trauma and are more likely to develop emotional problems later in life. And so they're working with first responders like police and school teachers and people at churches to identify children who have been exposed to violence at very young ages and getting a trauma-informed services into them at an early age before the disorders take hold and before they wind up part of the juvenile justice or criminal justice systems.
Judge Mack?
Well, there are over 340,000 people with severe mental illness incarcerated in America today. Less than 50,000 are in hospitals. I feel like it's back to the future. Prior to the 1850s, the mentally ill were kept in prison, and the reform movement led by Dorothy Dix was to provide institutions for persons with mental illness. And here we are again today. Once again, the primary institution for the mentally ill in America today is prison by a ratio of nearly 7 to 1. And I submit that a lot of that is because we cannot intervene early. People need treatment early, and they can't get it.
Why?
The standard for intervention by the courts is very high. In order for me to order treatment for someone who's mentally ill, they have to be in extreme danger of immediate harm, like suicide or homicide. On the other hand, for all other illnesses in Michigan, all you have to do is show that the person is incapacitated, that they don't understand their need for whatever treatment it is, whether it's cancer, tuberculosis, or anything else, and I can enter an order that allows that person to get treatment. I can't do it for mental illness. On the other hand, I can appoint a guardian for someone who's mentally ill. And let's say I appoint a guardian for someone who's mentally ill and has cancer. The guardian can consent to cancer treatment, but the guardian cannot consent to mental health treatment. If the guardian could consent to mental health treatment, then the person's capacity could be restored, and they could make their own decision about their cancer treatment. Huh. It's a bizarre system.
This sounds very catch-22.
It's bizarre.
And Dr. Reed, you must encounter this kind of catch-22 craziness constantly as you work with the Detroit Wayne County Community Mental Health Agency.
Right. What I would say is that no one in the mental health system will say that we disagree with the need to get early treatment. Mm-hmm. But what I think I'm saying is that it needs to be a two-pronged approach. Waiting until a person is already mentally ill and needing treatment on an involuntary basis, that's a downstream approach. We need that approach because, as Judge Mack is indicating, there are people in the court system and elsewhere that need treatment now. But also we need to take an upstream approach that Judge talked about earlier, which is preventing much earlier. We already know the risk factors for developing mental disorders. We know homelessness in families affects people. We know untreated substance abuse in families affects people. We know that adverse exposure to violence and trauma in small children increases the likelihood that you would have a mental disorder later in life or wind up in the juvenile justice system or the correction system. So it needs to be a two-pronged approach. We need a downstream approach to address those that have already developed mental disorders. And then we need a more upstream approach in terms of prevention to deal with these things early on. We work, for instance, a very innovative program here in Michigan that the state has supported, infant mental health. We are working with children from ages 0 to 6 who are high risk and getting needed services before they're hardly even in kindergarten. These are the effective programs and found, even with mothers with mental disorders, even more effective. So if you have a depressed mother who has issues with a small child, getting the needed services in there not only reduces the likelihood that the child will be in juvenile detention, but it also improves the mother's adherence to treatment and makes it more likely that the mother would take medication and go for services. So I'm saying we need a two-pronged approach. We need to deal with the current issue, but we also need to get very upstream in terms of prevention.
And I would agree with Dr. Reed. Dr. Reed and I both served on the Governor's Mental Health Commission, and we both described the system as broken, and it is broken. And I would submit that a mental health system that allows more people with mental illness to be incarcerated than treated is a system that's broken. In Wayne County, or actually in Michigan, the largest inpatient mental health provider is the Wayne County Jail. And just to make a little more personal, we had one of the district courts in Wayne County. This person was charged with a rather small misdemeanor, destruction of property or something. He can't make bond, so he's put in jail. He comes to court for his trial date, and the prosecutor says, well, Judge, he's been in jail for 30 days, so if he pleads guilty, he can be released for time served. Defense attorney says, that sounds good. And then the defendant says, excuse me, Judge, since I've been in the Wayne County Jail, I've been getting treatment for my mental illness. Could I have more time, please? Hmm. And the judge agrees and says, okay, I'll give you 30 more days. And then he says, in a Dickinsonian style, could I have some more, please? Hmm. And he got 60 days. So is that what it's come to? That if you have a mental illness in Michigan, you're looking for treatment in jail? I think that's a disgrace.
So can I ask both of you, especially you were on the governor's commission, are your calls, these clarion calls that you're both issuing, are they falling on deaf ears? Are efforts being made? Dr. Reed, you referred to the infant mental health program as something the state supports. That's good. But why does this exist? Is it being shoved aside in lieu of bigger problems?
Oh, I think it's just a multi-pronged approach. It's a complex set of situations can be diverted from jail. So, yes, there are programs out there. Are there enough programs, enough funding to meet the needs of everybody who needs them? Perhaps not. But again, a large part of it has to do with It's funding is an issue, of course. Mm-hmm. There's always a need for additional funding to serve additional individuals, but I think also it's a societal issue. People who have mental disorders and substance use disorders are not necessarily viewed the same way. The judge talked about somebody with cancer. They're not treated the same way with insurance. They're not viewed in the same way with regard to guardianship. And I think that with the health care reform that's coming, it's going to provide increased access to mental health services dramatically. The Veterans Administration has had a massive this year increase in access to mental health services. So part of it is, are there access to services through our community? Do the communities accept these services? I mean, do people really view a person who has a mental disorder the same way they view a person who has cancer to accept treatment and encourage them to get the help? I mean, you would never deny that a person has cancer. If you have a family member with breast cancer or colon cancer, you're out there encouraging them to get help. You visit them in the hospital.
Sure.
You go with them to appointments. But if your family member has a substance use disorder or a mental disorder or even a developmental disability, those disorders are not viewed in the same way as general medical problems. And I would propose that they are general medical problems that warrant us to support persons with disorders, that treatment is available, that treatment works, and that people who have mental disorders can and do recover from disorders. And I think that's what's most important.
And just to follow up with what mm-hmm. Dr. Reed said, we treat mental illness different legally than any other illness. And to me, that's a stigmatizing event.
Right, and in and of itself, yeah.
We should treat mental illness like we treat any other illness.
So this really needs a fundamental change in how all of us regard people who are mentally
right.
ill and easing that stigma. And how would both of you propose that happened? How do we ease that stigma of being mentally ill?
A lot of it has to do with the policymakers. Hmm. I mean, I had a rather shocking experience recently. I appeared in front of the Detroit Wayne County Community Mental Health Board to talk about a program Dr. Reed and I are working on to expand the use of Kevin's Law to try to get more help to people so that they stay out of trouble. And one of the board members pointed at me and said, "You know you can't help these people. You know this treatment doesn't work." And I was stunned. I mean, I expect that from maybe a rookie legislator who doesn't know any better. But if you're on the mental health board and you're saying that, that's kind of shocking.
I think one of the best ways that I see in fighting stigma is working with what we call peer support specialists, peer mentors, and peer advocates. These are children and adults who have mental disorders who have recovered and are actually part of our system. They become policymakers. They're designed in the design, delivery, and evaluation of the mental health system. So I think the easiest way to combat stigma is to have consumers, family members, and advocates more actively involved with boards, as we're required by the state, and also more actively involved in the design, delivery, and evaluation of the mental health system. So with people with mental disorders who have recovered are at the table during decision-making, you come out with a very different outcome, and colleagues and professionals begin to see them as part of the workforce. So I said the best way is to increase the members who have mental disorders in the workforce. That's, I think, one way to deal with it. I think also parity of mental health coverage has done a great thing to increase that. You know, maybe 10 years ago, Blue Cross Blue Shield, if you had a heart attack or a stroke, there was no limit to the benefits you could get for care from a heart attack or stroke. But for mental disorders, there might be a $400 a year or a $2,500 year limit, and you could only be in the hospital maybe 45 days. So with the parity acts in Michigan and Nashville, that also will help decrease and end discrimination in the medical field relative to health care coverage.
Something else in your toolbox.
Right. And actually, just to follow up, we had three members of the Mental Health Commission were people who had mental illness, who had been through the system, and who are doing well today. So it's important that people see that people with mental illness can function normally in society, hold down jobs, and be productive. The mental health system we have today, holds people back. If you have a mental illness and you manage to get access to care and you get treatment and you get well, if you get a job, you risk losing your coverage and going right back where you started. So in working with the Mental Health Association of Michigan, we've looked, and in fact, the Mental Health Commission recommended changing the law in that regard so that people who have been in the system and gotten help keep that help when they get well. I mean, it's been disappointing. We made about 70-some recommendations at the Mental Health Commission, and so far, nothing has been done. I think there may have been...
Why? Why do you think?
Inertia, it's a complicated area, very complicated. People don't understand it. I'm not sure the policymakers still realize that mental health is an illness which can be treated and people can recover. And trying to get the legislature and the administration to look at this kind of holistically in terms of, look, you've got a prison system which is has an awful lot of people in it who don't belong there because they're mentally ill. They should have gotten treatment instead, and reallocate the resources. And we have to restructure the mental health system in Michigan.
I would say, have 100% of the recommendations of the Mental Health Commission been taken up by the state? No. But there has been progress in several key areas. And I would say, is it enough? We can always do more. But I think in the area of suicide prevention, it has had a big impact. Every county, we have full activities relative to reducing suicide, and we're making progress in those areas. There has been expansion in terms of jail diversion services. There have been expansion and increased funding for outpatient services. Is it enough? No, but there has been progress in the area, but we're always continuing to push, as the judge said, that we can do better.
To me, the mental health system will be working when we have more people receiving treatment in healthcare hospitals than in prisons. I'm not saying hospitalize everybody, but we should not have such a high level of hospitalization of people with mental illness. Now, clearly, people with mental illness...
A high level of incarceration.
Right.
Yes.
We've got to release... And frankly, if you look at healthcare, the healthcare measures, performance measures, dashboards, whatever you want to call it, they are extensive throughout healthcare except mental illness.
I want to thank both of you. I know this is not the last we're going to be addressing this issue. It's complicated, and it does touch every corner of our state, homes where people are coping with this as parents, worrying about a child, or siblings worried about a sibling battling mental illness. And so I know we haven't solved this all today, and I want to thank both of you for your time. And I know we'll be talking again, the Honorable Milton Mack, Chief Judge of the Wayne County Probate Court, and Dr. Michelle Reed, the Medical Director of the Detroit Wayne County Community Mental Health Agency. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Still to come, Minnesota photographer Alec Soth recently traveled through Michigan, taking photos of average people and everyday life. A glimpse into Michigan life through the eyes of a visitor, coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. Welcome back. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you grew up in Southeast Michigan, brace yourself for a memory jolt. Tomorrow, it will be 30 years since Hudson's closed its downtown Detroit store. That 25-story building on Woodward was a touchstone for generations of Detroiters and people all through Southeast Michigan for whom a trip to Hudson's was a big occasion. Joining us now, Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry. Jack, is it safe to say that once that landmark store closed, downtown Detroit was never the same?
Well, it had never been the same for some time. There was a long period of decline. The store, which actually had more than 2 million square feet, had sort of shrunken. They weren't using all of it. They talked about closing it as early as the 1970s, early 1970s, because of the amount of pilferage. But it was a symbol. It was a symbol, one more symbol of a Detroit that used to be. And the sad thing is, as with a lot of other Detroit institutions, the people who were saddest or who protested its closing more were people who had ceased to come to the store.
That's a good point. In fact, you know, it's clearly known that the suburban shopping centers drew away the shoppers. In fact, that first suburban shopping center in the nation was Northland, right there in Southfield. So do you think that flagship Hudson's store was doomed the day that Northland opened its doors? Was it just a matter of time?
I don't know whether we can say that, but that certainly was the trend line. There was, right from the start in Northland, Hudson's put the first satellite store there, and people started moving away from downtown shopping. Detroit had, even when I was young, a system of streetcars. People would take the streetcars to Hudson's. It was a big deal. They would go show women put white gloves on. It probably was inevitable, and a lot of people attribute this to sort of racial tensions, but I think it was just attributed to sort of an emptying out of the downtown. Large industrial cities all over the nation, especially the Northeast and Midwest, have had trouble keeping their downtowns viable. And this store, of course, was much more a symbol than I think any other downtown, even more so maybe than Macy's in New York, because it was the biggest department store in the country. Had more square feet than any store in the world for a long time. Had the world's biggest flag on the side. And it was just sort of a symbol of the grandeur of industrial Detroit at its zenith.
You know, Jack, when you think of this story being repeated in cities all over Michigan, you've got those high-service department stores, B. Siegel and Mitzelfeld's and Jacobson's and Milliken's and Crowley's, and they were the heart of main streets in cities around the state. Do you think there was any way that they could have competed against both the suburban malls and then the big-box stores, the Targets and the Walmarts?
It's hard to see how they could. They were sort of a one-stop shop, and the problem is that they were built for an era before everybody drove to the store. People would take public transportation to the store or walk to the store, and they really didn't have the parking. And it really became more and more, as people moved out, it was more and more of a chore to go downtown. And after a few years, people lost touch with how to get there and where to park. And it just wasn't convenient. It was so much more convenient to go to a maybe more soulless and maybe less personal, but a satellite store or a big box store in a place like Northland Mall, which itself is now sort of has fallen on hard times.
Yes.
But there were other Hudson stores. The sort of irony is that Hudson's then went through various ownership changes and transmutations,
yeah,
and these successor stores are now called Macy's stores.
And it's funny how often I hear myself and people I know, you mean to say I went to Macy's, and somehow because you're going to Oakland Mall or whatever, you say you're going to Hudson's. That brand identity is hard to shake.
It's kind of a generational thing. There are some people for a decade or so it was Marshall Fields.
Right.
In fact, I do that too, but to my surprise, not that many people say Hudson's anymore.
Yeah. What was it, do you think, Jack? Because you grew up going there, I grew up going there. What was it about the experience of the shopping and the event of it that today's generation will never, never experience?
And, of course, nostalgia always adds a little tint of, nothing was perfect, but it was a destination. You went, you made a day of it. You got dressed up to go there. In fact, and they had so many different departments, and the fans of the Little House on the Prairie books, Laura Ingalls Wilder, went there and read from her books, and her husband, Almanzo, who fans of the books may remember, said the best meal he ever had in his life was in downtown Hudson's because they gave him so much food to eat in the cafeteria. So you could literally spend all that day there, and a lot of people did, and there were facilities for children. It was a very well laid out and managed store. So it was an all-day event. It was like, for I guess today's generation, if they were to go to a mall like the Great Lakes Crossing Mall and go from store to store,
yeah,
back then you could do everything at Hudson's.
Jack, do you foresee any way for these Main Street shopping districts to ever regain any of the past glory such as that? No one's going to make the big occasion like it was, but certainly a question to ask in the discussion about revitalizing the downtowns of our cities.
I think as long as people have access to private transportation and gasoline is affordable, probably not. But the end of that day may come. It's very dangerous to say never. But having said that, it's very hard to see a store like Hudson's existing or reviving in the near future. We're thinking it's almost an analogy with the automotive industry, where in the Detroit in Hudson's heyday, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler dominated everything. That's never going to happen again. Those companies have survived. But we're thinking that we're looking to a world that has much more diversity in terms of income, of how people work, what people do, and also shopping. But anybody who says they know what the retail world's going to be like 50 years from now knows nothing whatsoever.
Jack, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's senior political analyst. The Hudson's building was demolished in a spectacular implosion October 24, 1998. It took nearly 3,000 pounds of explosives to bring the once glorious building down. Today, the site is a city-owned underground parking lot. Everyone has a story. Everyone. It just takes the right person with a sense of caring and curiosity to ask the right questions with the right attitude to get people to open up and share their stories. And then it takes someone to share all those stories with the rest of us. Well, that someone is my next guest. Photographer Alex Soth has been publishing his irregularly published newspaper through his Little Brown Mushroom Publishing House. It's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Alex and writer Brad Zeller recently traveled through Michigan. The results, a new body of work entitled LBM Dispatch Michigan, with a limited edition paper and series of 68 new photographs by Alec, now on exhibit at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills. So let's see how Michigan looked to the eyes of a traveler. Photographer Alex Soth joins us now from Minnesota. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what brought you and Brad to Michigan? What was your mission?
Well, it all started, I have this exhibition up at Cranbrook, and this is a traveling exhibition, which was originated in Minnesota. But as it's moving around, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to create new, fresh work that could be exhibited alongside this work from the previous 10 years and sort of do a pop-up exhibition with these fresh stories, this fresh take on this place. And the truth is, I knew very little about Michigan. You know, I'm a hardcore Midwesterner, but I didn't know the state well, and so this provided an opportunity to go on a little adventure.
So it was that adventure ran through like late October into early November.
Yeah, it's about 2 weeks long, yeah. And this is the third such trip that Brad and I have taken on, and this is kind of experimental, very fluid process where we go on these 2 week road trips with an assistant, and then publish a paper of the journey a mere week after the production. So, and alongside that, with Cranbrook, we produced a pop up exhibition, also within a week after having completed this trip. So it's almost like a crazy endurance marathon.
So where did you travel to? You tried to get off the main highways, didn't you, and get into all kinds of towns?
Yeah, that's always the goal. I mean, there's this kind of cliche about America that it's all strip malls and, Olive Gardens and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it doesn't take much driving off the freeway to discover, the strange, rich, nuanced, country, which is varies so that, Michigan can look very different than Minnesota. And in fact, one of the great things about this journey is that I realized just how varied Michigan was. Brad and I started, coming from Minnesota, we went north and up through the UP and then circled down through the middle of the state down to Detroit and then westward from there, and just saw so much variation. I mean, radical variation. I mean, if you think about, the UP and Detroit,
yes,
it's quite a contrast.
Certainly. And so give us your sense of the kind of people you talk to. And I was struck with Brad's essay with how impressed he was with what he called the love that people you talk to had for Michigan.
Absolutely, it was notable, and something, you know, very peculiar for me, because I'd never been to the UP whatsoever, and I feel like, you know, Wisconsin is more connected to it than Michigan. I mean, and so, you know, you talk to some kids, and they talk about what they want to do when they grow up, and it's not that they want to go live in Green Bay, which is not far away. They want to go to Detroit. Mm. And so there is this kind of state pride, which I think is great, actually. It's, you know, again, you know, I deal with a foreign audience very often. My work is often exhibited overseas. And there's this sense that America is this one thing, and it's not. It's so fragmentary, and state identity is part of it, and there is a real love of the state of Michigan, for sure.
And you found that even in challenged places like Flint and Saginaw and Detroit, you found hopeful people.
Yeah, I mean, it goes both ways. Yeah. It's, you know, and I should say that these pictures were made right before the election, so that was kind of hovering over this whole project, and we kind of thought of it as this election issue, but we didn't want to be overly explicit about that. And what was interesting is that the people that we talked to and photographed weren't overly explicit about it either, despite all of the media hype. They might talk hopefully or you know, despairingly of what's happening economically. But it wasn't so tied to politics. It was tied to, you know, very real life issues.
And you and Brad endeavored to talk to politicians and business people, and one might just say the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that go?
Yeah, it was a struggle. I mean, this is one of the great problems that I deal with as a photographer, is that, you know, so often people look at my work and they say, "Wow, you seem to focus more on, you know, underprivileged communities." And the fact of the matter is, if you're driving around meeting with strangers, it tends to be people on the lower end of the economic spectrum who are sitting out on their porches. People with wealth often, you know, have fences up. And so sort of penetrating those fences can be challenging. At the time of this trip, it was almost bizarrely challenging, where it seemed like, you know, in the least threatening way possible, we would approach people and just have huge issues. And in fact, there was a sense that in this pre-election time, it was the wealthy that was sort of more aware of election politics and the way they might be identified or personified or what have you.
And concerned with that.
Yeah, and concerned with that, when in fact we didn't have a great agenda. We just wanted, you know, diversity in the portrayal. And you know, this election for me was so much about, the kind of radical divide in the economic strata. I mean, and, you know, all the talk of the 1%, the 99%, the 47%, and in fact, you know, I just felt that time and time again on this trip, and particularly, you know, in the Detroit, you know, area there with Bloomfield Hills, where we were staying, and where Cranbrook is, and that this community could reside so close to this other community is fascinating, and you know, and just sort of intoxicating from a journalistic perspective.
In the piece that your partner Brad wrote, he had a wonderful line that says, "Dignity dies hard," and it was describing your encounter with an old man on the east side of Detroit. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, we were driving around Detroit, and I have to say that in Detroit, we were really concerned about how to portray this city, because particularly in photographic circles, it's almost become a cliche, you know, this sort of ruin porn,
yes,
as it's called, and we were both kind of wary, how do we deal with this? And one of our thoughts was the fact that we start in the UP, nature, and we come to Detroit, and the city, which you know, there's a big push of a sort of return to nature and of urban gardening and what have you. And so we thought we would focus on that. And we were driving around, and we met this man, Howard, who was working in this asparagus patch at a community garden. And it was another case where, you know, you just drive up, you talk to a stranger, and the warmth that a total stranger can have, where they don't necessarily ask, you know, what this is for, what our agenda is, and just sharing a part of their life and a part of their story, it was really meaningful.
What do you feel that your photographs say about Michigan and its people, Alec?
I'm a photographer. I look at the world. I look at the exterior surface of the world and try to figure out what's going on underneath, but I don't necessarily know any more than the next guy. And I'm wary as a photographer of sort of making any great proclamations. What I will say is that America, you know, the United States, Michigan as well, is a profoundly sort of rich territory to look into. It's like I don't need to travel across seas. There's as much interesting things for me to look at in Flint as there is in, you know, Bangladesh. But that said, there is room for despair. I mean, at what's happening economically in this country, and I could see that all over Michigan as well.
Alec, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Alec Silth's photo exhibit is now showing at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills through March 30th, and Alec will be giving a lecture at Cranbrook. That'll be Sunday, January 27th at 3 p.m., and we'll put a link to Cranbrook's site on our website at michiganradio.org so you can get all the details on the exhibit and Alec's lecture. Here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. Tell us what you think of the stories we've broadcast or people we should talk to. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, or on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Today's show was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, and Cameron Stewart. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow at 3:00.